This is Kana. And I'm here with Abigail and Dalton. We're here to talk about two pieces, one by Maurice Condé, who sadly recently passed earlier this month. And so this podcast would be in her memory. And then we have Creolite Bites, an interview with Chamisso Confiant and Jean Vernabi. They were interviewed by Lucienne Taylor, and so we're here to talk about those two pieces. And I think I'll start with my overall assessment. I really enjoyed our discussion yesterday in class. I think we gain a lot from different subjectivities with the two pieces. The Creolist is an extension of what we discussed last week, just talking. Explaining further about the Creolite movement and where they see themselves. I think with Condé's piece, we kind of see like the descent. It seemed to me that sometimes they're at odds, even if they are talking about the same thing. So they're kind of like frenemies of sorts. She's not too keen on Fanon either. But she does ally herself, I saw, with Suzanne Césaire and other Caribbean women writers. Overall, I think that the interview, although it was, I guess, polemical, it's controversial. I think that it's consistent with the way that we were introduced to them last week. And so I felt like I can understand their pace and where they're coming from, but I did appreciate Condé's insertion of the female perspective. Anybody else have thoughts?
I agree. Thank you, Kana, for starting us off. Something I really appreciated about both is that they're both talking about in their own way what does Creole identity mean, and especially what does this mean if you move to the diaspora, what does this mean in terms of languages, in terms of culture. Something I tying back to what you said specifically on gender. That I appreciate from Condé's work is that she does a really great analysis of pre-existing literature with West Indian novels and this concept of, for example, a hero should be male, there shouldn't be mentions of sex, and even though these are still works that are leaning away towards like trying to lean away from colonial writing, there is still some issues with patriarchy. And I appreciate that she specifically goes into that. And Dalton, I'm curious to know what stood out to you in regards to either work.
Yeah, I appreciated that Professor Drabinsky put these pieces together as a way of not only hearing further from the Creolists about how they experience and see Creole, Creolite, Creolism, or Creolization, I should say, as a process and how it's unfolding and how it has unfolded since they introduced the concept, especially particularly in the Antilles, and then also to add Condé's like. Criticism that we hear about quite a bit, from Condé and from other people in the interview with the Creolists, and where they descend into sort of their anger, I guess, with diasporic writers of Creolism. Yeah, I found both texts really interesting, but I'd like to repeat what you all have already said, found Condé's piece, really essential. And then also I felt like it was even it was her point was made clear in the interview where the Creolists made some comments that were not only misogynistic but also they doubled down on their reasoning for including misogynistic depictions of women, particularly Martinican women, in their novels, as like they excuse this as simply like the way things are here. And Condé would know this if she lived in the Caribbean, right? But as we talked about in class a bit, they don't in then interrogate how it is those beliefs came to exist, and why they are so like why they have reached the point of appearing to them and to other people who read their works as like naturally occurring, right? Like as like something that's always been around. So I like that Condé is pointing that out, saying, you know, even returning to her criticisms of Fanon, that they're like even if Fanon was attempting to produce like a pathology of blackness in relation to whiteness, that it didn't have to then mimic the anti-black like and or I guess misogynoir of Europe, and that it probably could have been achieved absent that, or even like in tandem with it, right? Like if Fanon had returned to his own illustration of black women to point out what, you know, why it is black women may act in the way that he was pathologizing, because he seems to do that more with black men, right? Like that, because I assume because it takes like that auto theoretical position where he's implicating himself, and he's unable to do that and then unwilling to do it for black women. But yeah, anyways, I think these two pieces work very well together, so I appreciate that they were read as a pair.
Dalton, something you were saying is reminding me, or just echoing, like our discussion in the class about what the problem is that the Creolists have with Condé and even Abby too. You were talking about like this, like what do we do with the diasporic writer, like the role that they play. And I guess I'm just needing a little bit more clarity, because even in my reading of that interview, I'm seeing that they're not saying, or you know, like one of the things they called, they said, oh well, to their naysayers, the Creolists, they were saying, well, they're stupid. And I had a, you know, I thought that they were talking specifically about Condé or something like that. But I'm looking at page 151, and I guess in explanation, this is Raphael. He's saying, we don't have anything to learn from these people in the States. Diasporic discourse shouldn't override indigenous discourse. It should be a complementary vision. And so I feel that their issue is coming from a, I think I agree in part that there shouldn't be anything overriding one another, and that the goal should be these complementary visions. But I disagree that they can't learn anything from a diasporic writer, from a female writer. And I think that that's where they become misunderstood in saying that, you know, or like, I think some people assume that they mean that diasporic writers don't have anything to add to the discourse. We sat in on that talk at Myth yesterday, and I remember one of the panelists saying that there's this assumption among academics that what we're theorizing about, we've created, right? And so I think maybe the Creolists are saying a similar thing, that people who read Condé might think that what Condé is coming up with is brand new versus it already existing in that space. And so just being very careful and ethical about how we theorize as diasporic writers, I think is probably what they're saying. What are your thoughts on that?
Thank you, Kena. I'm really glad you brought that up. There's like I have a lot of thought pieces because you said so many great things. In terms of your first point, bringing up the DS fork writer, I think that's really interesting because I definitely agree, and we've had conversations in class of this, of how many times the Caribbean writers who lived in the diaspora were either being cited more or their work was essentially like more popular than writers who were living in the Caribbean. I think just based on my own experience, because I'm originally from Puerto Rico, but I grew up in the diaspora, like I have some mixed feelings of that. And I think that is just because I personally grew up in the diaspora. But I think it's really interesting because a conversation specifically happening within Puerto Rico, for example, is that so there's value in both experiences, and like you said, not to override each other. But something that came up in one of my friend's dissertation defenses today, so she's now Dr. Cedeño González. She was bringing up how when she's in her dissertation, she's looking at Puerto Rican literature, both in the island and the diaspora, and she was saying, when you don't have both experiences, sometimes it feels incomplete, or it's not having a true like representation specifically within PR, just because there's so much of migration back to the island and then to the diaspora. So those are kind of my thoughts on like this concept of the Creole writer like who leaves the island. And then something else you mentioned in terms of, sorry, I lost my train of thought, but that was the main point that I thought was interesting. Oh yeah, something else you mentioned about how in the talk you went to yesterday with Dr. JMJ, there is issues where like you said, academics, there's a notion that academics are like creating this knowledge as if it doesn't exist. And that kind of concept of emphasis on the written word is something I had noticed in both of the texts. And like, I understand that, like, you know, I'm not saying this literature isn't important, but something that was on page 151 that Condi mentioned is the interview with Glissant saying, "I don't believe the West Indian literature exists yet, since literature supposes an action and the reaction between a public and audience." I think the concept of, like with academia, unless something is written down, it's not always taken seriously. And then Condi also does a really great job talking about how West Indian literature, particularly, is not taken seriously when writers are talking about nature or talking about art, or it's viewed as this imitation and not true experiences or true knowledge. And Dalton, I don't know if you have any thoughts regarding this or anything else that you appreciated in either of the texts.
Yeah, thank you both. Yeah, I think like it's interesting that the Creolists take diasporic writers as their like as their primary, at least in the interview, and maybe because of the phrasing of the questions or the way that like the whole like what the whole thing is framed, that diasporic authors, Caribbean authors, are like their primary adversaries when like it seems they're also applying disappointment or justifiable anger towards like voyeuristic writers of and about the Caribbean, and that being those being like mostly Europeans, right? And also later Americans and people from the Americas who are not Caribbean but are also like displaying this idealistic, exotic image of the Caribbean, and then the Creolists take Caribbean diasporic writers as mimicking that, which I think is a kind of a stretch, because as Conde like critiques, like the diasporic authors also have something new by way of like the shifting, their shifting conditions, experiences, etc. in the world that are inevitably influencing even the memory of that they have of their home in the Caribbean, right? And I don't think that that's like the Creolists see that as a problem as opposed to like an opening for possibilities. But then I also appreciated that in the interview, Camusot has this part where he says, like, literature, it's on page 150. He says, literature doesn't protect you from the wounds of locality, which we have to deal with like anyone else in the Antilles. And I appreciated that that was like a reminder of like this, the real implications of, because like here he's talking about having to deal with, actually being in debates with your neighbors or experiencing the harm and violence of a still colonized or pseudo-colonized space. And then later with the question of Caesar's political ameliorations and betrayals, that they are like actually seeing and experiencing the consequences of. So yeah, I can fathom through that their disappointment in diasporic authors writing on what they see as like their immediate circumstances, right? But I also don't think the criticism can fully adequately wash away the imagination that they seem to want from Creolization that is also offered by diasporic authors.
Yes, thank you both for helping me think through that problem. I think I understand it a little bit better now. Yeah, I second everything that you all were saying. I think that's very important. Or we had also talked about like the primacy of the written word and like and literature in general. For its way of, it's it being able to be preserved in a different way, preserving imagination in a different way than orality, can. I'm not sure where else we want to go. I think we talked a little bit about creolization as a concept, compared to Americanization, I think, is what the Creolists are trying to figure out the valences between. We talked a little bit about, I guess, the spatial, which we were just talking about as far as like diasporic writers, the spatial aspect of it, but I was also seeing that they were talking about a temporal aspect to it and how much time impacts Creolization. We spoke a little bit about chaos, and like how that is a feature of creolization as they're imagining it, how it's shocking that culture. I'm not sure in what like what kind of intervals, but I do think that the idea of a shock and stuttering has been, a trope that I've been seeing across all the different thinkers that we've been interacting with.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the time question is really intriguing to me because I think you're right to say that there's like this this shock problem and that like they're the Creolists in particular are very insistent that the Antilles is unique geographically and then as like their Creolization is unique because it's this almost like the truer essence of like the mixing pot thing that's been assigned to the West, right? Which is like, this blending of cultures for multiracialism and, like progression, etc. And they see the Antilles as like a more legitimate expression of that. But I think like it's interesting the way that they They almost like disavow the impact of enslavement elsewhere in order to advance the uniqueness of the Antilles. And I think that that is a disservice. Like this was particularly apparent in like their discussion of Moronage in the Americas. And it was interesting seeing them protect the Creole concept against Moronage. And I'm not sure that that was is like a necessarily an effective or bit like useful approach for them to have taken. I think, I don't know, maybe that's just my own like opinion and like interceding, but I do think that Moronage is an interesting would be an interesting and useful addendum to Creolization that they sort of disavow in order to like keep Creole what they believe it is. But I think that relates going back to this concept of time or the question of time. Those things relate because, like, as I said, they are experiencing the changes right up and up close and personally in the Antilles. But I think again, like the that then doesn't interrogate the differences, like the actual or the similarities between different places and how they've experienced time. And also, as I mentioned in class, the threat of like the imperial power and also of like assimilation, you know, like in where in the Americas, it's much more difficult to maintain and then carefully construct a Creole where, you know, in the Antilles, they're able to actually try to practice and they try to do this literary, like in a literary setting, you know, they're trying to work on the very micro linguistic stuff in order to like produce something like Creole, right? Which doesn't happen, isn't allowed to happen as fluidly elsewhere. And I think they see that it wasn't allowed to happen as fluidly in the time where they believe and spend most of the time deciphering Creolization, right? Like in the 1800s, 1700s, and then early 20th century as well, where it was fluid because of colonial violence and enslavement, right? And then also after the 1848 abolition of enslavement, the mass transport of Indian and Chinese and Southeast Asian people to the Caribbean. So I really think time is like a fascinating component in this that it would be interesting to like hear more about.
Thank you, Dalton. I'll pick your brain just a little bit more. You mentioned the term Moronage. Is that just race mixing, or what was your understanding of that term?
As far as I understand, the Moronage they were talking about is enslaved people's communities or runaway enslaved people producing communities in hiding across particularly across the South. There were also Moronage communities in the North, and one of the largest ones was like in the Great Dismal Swamp. It's essentially like mostly Black and then also Indigenous peoples that fled enslavement and the plantation system to live in community with one another.
Makes sense.
So and I think this like to bring this point further too, the Creolization that they're discussing is they admit is a consequence of the slave trade, right? And it's a consequence of like the forced atomization of the plantation, which, as we talked about in class, like then makes possible Creolization. But I'm not sure why they refuse that. I mean, they don't refuse it outright, but they just don't, they aren't as willing to include Moronage or other spaces where Black people in subjugated positions created community from the lack thereof. I don't know if they're like, and I imagine people have written about the differences in the specific conditions that they want to clarify are important to Creolization, but
Right.
clear to me.
Right. I have a theory that I guess the male, at least from what I've seen so far, that our male Francophone thinkers are treating history differently than female writers have. You know, when I think about Suzanne Césaire and Maurice Condé, I feel like there's more of a willingness on one side to, you know, find a place for history versus on the other side using I don't know if it's like trying to use the right the here and now and think in a sense of futurity is kind of what I'm thinking they're doing, where they're not trying to get hung up on the root of something more so than I guess like what we're producing in the here and now and onwards. But I brought up Condé. I know Abby had some thoughts, you know, and found some really poignant things in the Condé piece. And so I'm not sure if you're seeing a thread between what Dalton and I were just talking about and maybe something different that Condé's saying.
Thank you both for all of that. I did, before I go back into Condé, I did want to go back to one of the readings we did earlier during the semester, thinking of Camusot's definition of Creole in Praise of Creoleness. On page 893, they mention in multiracial societies such as ours, it seems urgent to quit using the traditional raciological distinctions and to start again designating the people of our countries, regardless of their complexion, by the only suitable word, Creole. And Dalton, to your point of how they don't really talk about Marinage and like Black communities that are not necessarily Creole. That was something I also like had an issue with. And I feel like in the definition that I just mentioned, like it seems a little limited in terms of how they're defining Creole and not like I think what was missing for me was also like the mention of Marinage communities. So I'm glad you brought that up. In terms of Condé's work, I did like how she went back to Glissant and how he is really looking at Creole, particularly with language. And then how she's also looking at one of Glissant's models for fiction writers. I'll be honest, like I feel like what we have mentioned earlier about how in some ways they are saying the same things, just like differently, is something that kind of came up to me. So I don't have like a particular instance where I have like a specific way of how she was talking about this like extremely differently. But I'm curious if anything else like stood out to you. Of how either Condé was looking at Creolism or also Kena, I'm really interested because you briefly touched on like how she talks about gender and like the importance of the female Caribbean writer, if anything stood out to you in that regard also.
Yes, and I agree. I think even in class, I felt like each, you know, both Condé and the Creolists, like they have a parallel thrust, but to me it seemed like it was kind of one that was oppositional. So this is on page. Right, the paragraph that starts the disorder segment of Condé's piece. So on page 160, she says, in a Bambara myth of origin, after the creation of the earth and the organization of everything on its surface, disorder was introduced by a woman. And she goes on to say that disorder meant creativity. So she, I get the same sort of, I guess, declarative statements from Condi that I do from the Creolists, where they each take this really firm stance on where they feel like, I don't know if, the movement should, like, where the movement should be centered, or I'm not sure. But I think that I do appreciate the call to have, the call to value a Black feminist lens that isn't just limited to she's either Creole women are inherently vile and masculine, that I think the Creolists were trying to reduce it to. But yes, I'll have to keep looking for things that I thought were different, but I think you're right in saying that, and even the Creolists admit that their first piece, I think it's the Eloge, Condi had a she didn't have very many negative things to say about that. Like, so their issue isn't, they just, I don't know, they're, I guess, unwilling to, dig a little deeper into the issue of gender than Condi would appreciate.
Yeah, and I think the issue of gender, like I mentioned here earlier and in class, also that is like to me important to the content of a language, and I think like on page 161, going back to what I mentioned earlier about Fanon failing to put his own like common sense into question, where Condé says contrary to what Frantz Fanon thinks and says. De Suisse Martiniquais is a precious written testimony. That's the book, I believe, is a precious written testimony, the only one that we possess of the mentality of a West Indian girl in those days, of the impossibility for her to build up an aesthetics which was an, would enable her to come to terms with the color of her skin. So already in one sentence, Condé is able to do what Fanon was unwilling to do in Black Skin, White Mass, right? And I think like that analysis that she offers here doesn't actually like disorder Fanon's the content of Fanon's claim. It just like changes its implications drastically. Does that make sense? Like it can still exist, and also the framing is much more empathetic, much more in like much just plain less misogynistic, right? And I think this is a useful illustration of like what the Creolists could do with their writing, but refuse to. And I think it betrays what they want from Creolization at the end of the day, because like, and again, it's still speaking French, just, you know, translated in their language.
Thank you so much for that. I guess I did want to ask if there were any last things that stood out to you as we do start to wrap up and like there's any last statements you want to make as we've been talking about both of these pieces and what we've learned throughout class, particularly with the Creolist thought.
Yeah, I think there's a lot here. I might have to like go back through and really pore over it, but I do like the attention that's paid, even if it's contention, that's paid to the diasporic writer and their role, and like or even how Creolization would impact them, I think that that was something that I'll walk away from the discussion, just remembering because of, I guess, my relation to that side of things. I liked the we talked a little bit about just their posture, the Criollas. I'm getting used to this attitude about certain people. Like, I kept thinking of Carmen Kennard, who's, in a different field. She's in rhetoric, Black feminist rhetoric and things like that. But just that same, like, them doing a manifesto and promising that they're not here to make people feel good about what they're saying, right? Like, I think that that's a very unique position, right? I think we called it a, like a an attic, an attitude or a pedagogy of refusal. We talked about in class, and so, it's a acquired taste, I think, but not one that has turned me off completely. So I like that about these pieces.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that like I liked the way Krilite Bites is organized in that like it's not only like filled in with art and images of the Caribbean but also of like some of the literature that they mention but don't really dive into. Like for instance there's like a letter to Saisaire from I forget which of the three but yeah, I thought, especially going to that letter, I think it was Raphael Confiant, but I'm not sure. I'll have to find it again. But in prior to that, there's a letter or an essay that's replicated from written by Saisaire. And I looked it up because I was trying to figure out when it was written because they don't really talk about it in the paper. I mean, in the interview, and I don't know if it was something that the authors put in later as a juxtaposition to the later replication of Confiant's letter to Saisaire because they're very similar. But looking up Saisaire's essay, it was written, people think it was written in 1935. So he would have been 22 at the time. So this is like well before Saisaire turned to the political and also. Like it was interesting. It was like I've heard the context of his political, I don't know, stint, I guess, later in his life. And Discourse on Colonialism is probably one of my favorite books ever. And it's still frustrating to see that contrast because Discourse on Colonialism is vehemently radical. But then he's like takes this assimilationist position. As a politician, but anyways, in the letter that's replicated, as you all know, like there's this this expressed frustration that young Saisaire has with older assimilationists, and then Confiant replicates this later, like I think 60 years later. I don't think that far, actually, probably like 40 years, when. To a Saisaire now in the political arena, saying essentially the same thing that they're opposed to assimilation. And then to tie this back into the actual content of the interview, there's a part where the Criollas say, we expect to be usurped, but then also to fight for our concept, like to fight for Creolization and to like battle younger people. Over it. And that was to me kind of an odd thing because, again, it sort of goes against what they claim to want for Creolization. But also, it's like, and again, maybe this is because they aren't aware of the letter that from Saisaire that was, or the essay from Saisaire that was replicated in the text. But yeah, it just seems like an odd cycle of producing what could be. I don't like the word progressive, but like, creative concepts and then trying to protect them to the point where you become reactionary.
You so much, Dalton and Kana. And I think something that well, just one of the many points and quotes that I'll sit with is for example on page 160, Condi says, "We live in a world where already frontiers have ceased to exist. Guadeloupe and Martinique, for better or for worse, have entered the European common market and welcome on their soil thousands of men and women from all sorts of countries." So I think looking at this in like our current world of globalization, and particularly I was thinking with social media in our digital age of like how this Creole identity, how it will remain salient, even when there's gentrification or moving to the diaspora, other people coming into the Caribbean who are not Creole, and how that will be expressed like either through literature, art, and now like on social platforms, because that's like the age we're in. So those are some points I'll think of, especially as you both mentioned the temporal aspect of how is this important like over time and like where we are now. So thank you both.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this talk. Until next time.